Khalifa, his vicegerent, and the sin of the earth, Allah will definitely mix this.
Right.
Allah will definitely make it. And no one can stand in front of Allah's will and power.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Dr. Alavi. Thank you, dear listeners. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you for joining in. Until another episode, take good care. And keep listening to the enlightening waves of IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Black Box. Part 1.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the name of God, on the night of February 25th to 26th, 2025, Israeli fighter jets carried out airstrikes in the city of Al-Qiswa, located south of Damascus, the capital of Syria. Shortly after, Al Jazeera released a statement saying, the Israeli bombardment in the Al-Qiswa region of rural Damascus targeted military positions belonging to the former Syrian army. Following this line of reporting, the Saudi channel Al Hadath released a report alleging, in a separate incident, that the Israeli army had raided sites used by Iranian militias, quote-unquote, located between the provinces of Quneitra and Dar'a in southern Syria. Qatari channel Al Jazeera and Saudi channel Al Hadath chose to mislead their viewers regarding the Israeli attacks in Syrian territory, attempting to claim that these strikes are not aimed at Syria, its people, its capabilities, or its sovereignty. Instead, they portray these actions as mere bombings targeting military facilities of a long-gone army or against militias that no longer exist in Syria. As a result, Al Jazeera and Al Hadath are trying to convince us that these bombings and attacks are insignificant and have no military or political repercussions, suggesting that we can simply overlook them as if they don't exist. On the same night of the bombing, which also saw an Israeli ground incursion into various areas of southern Syria, some media outlets supportive of the new Syrian regime claim that there is only one occupation in Syria, which they assert has ended, the occupation of power by Bashar al-Assad. Once again, this suggests that there is no Israeli occupation of Syrian territories, nor is there an American occupation, even though the enemy took control of these areas just weeks ago, not 50 years ago. They have recently occupied strategically significant Syrian lands covering hundreds of square kilometers. In other words, this stance implies that the extent of the enemy's occupation of Syrian territories and the ongoing attacks against Syria are secondary issues that can be overlooked, allowing life to continue as if nothing has happened. This is in fact referred to as normalization with the occupation, and it has no other name. The perspectives of Al Jazeera and Al Hadath on one hand, and those of certain journalists who support the new Syrian regime on the other, closely resemble the views of Syria's new leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani. He has consistently stated in various interviews that the rationale for Israeli attacks in Syria has been nullified due to the regime's collapse and the withdrawal of Iran and Hezbollah from the country. Al-Jolani's statements, which we will discuss further in the episode, appear to reflect a stance of neutrality regarding the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights, which has been in place since 1967. Additionally, they seem to express a neutral position on the recent Israeli occupation of Syrian territory, along with the enemy's intention to create what they refer to as a buffer zone encompassing the entire southern region of Syria. Our episode today doesn't focus on Al Jazeera, Al Hadath, or some media outlets that seek to downplay the gravity of the occupation. Our episode today focuses on the Israeli invasion of Syria and its true objectives, as reported by the United States. However, our country's mainstream media has chosen to ignore it and dismiss it as insignificant. On December 8, 2024, as Damascus fell to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, formerly known as the al-Nusra Front, the Israeli occupation army declared the launch of Operation Bashan Arrow. This marked the largest ground invasion of an Arab country outside the occupied territories of Palestine since 1982. The announcement was paired with the most extensive aerial operation in Syria's history, featuring possibly over 1,000 airstrikes targeting numerous regions across the country. The outcome of the Israeli invasion was an expansion of the occupied Syrian territory, which originally included the Golan Heights, seized in 1967, and now encompasses more than 30 villages, towns, and farms that are currently under the direct control of enemy forces. Areas such as Gunetra, Mount Hermon, and part of rural Dar'a are now under the control of the Israeli occupation army. According to multiple reports, the area occupied by Israel in Syria after December 8, 2024, not including the Golan Heights, reached more than 460 square kilometers. An area larger than that occupied by enemy forces in Gaza and Lebanon has been affected by over 16 months of fighting during the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. After bolstering its presence and positions in Syrian territory, the Israeli occupation army has become a key player in the evolving political landscape of Syria. In recent weeks, enemy leaders have set various boundaries for the new regime in Damascus and have started to exploit sectarian and ethnic tensions within Syria. With blatant audacity, the occupying entity, through its political and military officials, announced that it was obstructing the development of the new Syrian regime's army in southern Syria. Almost immediately, enemy leaders began to incite the residents of the Syrian province of Soweida to align with their sect members in the Golan Heights and occupied Palestine. The situation escalated to a point where the occupying leaders threatened to intervene in Jarahmana, which lies within the administrative borders of the Syrian capital, Damascus, using the old Israeli justification of protecting minorities. This grim scenario in the new Syria presents two tragic dimensions, making it challenging to determine which is more sorrowful than the other. The first dimension involves the significant losses we all endure due to the enemy's actions on the ground, which they never anticipated, reaching a level that various observers have described as Israel's current transformation of the Syrian landscape. As for the second dimension of the tragedy, perhaps more intricate than the first, is the contempt, indifference, and near lethargy that accompany this momentous event. The only thing missing to underline the defeat is the sight of Israeli tanks rolling into the center of the Syrian capital, Damascus, God forbid. The significance of Syria to the Israeli enemy extends beyond mere geography. It encompasses both political and moral dimensions. Geographically, Syria represents one half of the nation, with Egypt being the other half. Throughout history, Syria, also known as the Levant, has served as a gateway to the conquest and liberation of the region. The historical link between Egypt and Syria has been crucial for the nation's revival. Consequently, it became essential to create a colonial entity that would act as a demographic and geographical barrier hindering communication between Egypt and Syria, as well as between the western and eastern parts of the nation. Regionally, Syria, along with Egypt and Iraq, was a significant demographic and political force among Arabs, playing the key role in the pursuit of an independent Arab project. However, following the diminished influence of Egypt due to the Camp David Accords in 1978 and 1979, Iraq was destroyed and then occupied in 2003. Syria remained the sole foundation upon which a genuine Arab initiative could be built to challenge American dominance and Zionist arrogance in the region. This is why Syria has consistently been a source of concern for Israel. Not only did it refuse to surrender to the enemy and accept the occupation of its lands, its occupation of all our territories, not just its own, but it also represented a popular political experience that bolstered the resilience and growth of resistance forces in the region, especially after 1982, the year when Beirut, the Lebanese capital, was occupied and destroyed. In response, Syria was able to strengthen its economy and military capabilities to the extent that it maintained a balance of power through fear with its Israeli enemy for many years. Up until 2011, Syria was a significant regional player on the U.S. sanctions list, and even more importantly, a major contender among the powers deemed a threat to Israel, according to the enemy's own research institutions. Ideologically, Syria represents the older brother to those resisting Israel. This role has persisted for decades owing to its geographical and strategic proximity to Lebanon and Palestine, as well as the deep-rooted cultural and social identity of the Levant, or Greater Syria. This identity continues to be evident despite colonial divisions and has played a crucial role in Syria's regional influence, a role that can only be sustained or developed at the expense of Israel. As a result, there was a mutual understanding between the Israeli enemy and the Syrian state and people that the region could not accommodate the simultaneous presence and rise of both parties. Therefore, Syria has consistently been on Israel's agenda, whether through direct occupation, destruction, or division. The losses experienced by Syria and its entire population due to this invasion are beyond what we can fully document. Undoubtedly, the human toll of martyrs and the injured is most profound and significant. However, beyond the human cost, we can identify three additional types of losses in the areas of Syria occupied by Israel. One, loss of territory. Two, loss of resources. And three, perhaps the most critical, the loss of consciousness. The loss of land is the most apparent and significant issue at hand. Based on our extensive experience with the Zionists, we understand that land loss is not a temporary setback or merely a gradual shift that ends with the conclusion of military operations. The clear intentions and the ongoing plans of the Zionist agenda reveal that the occupation of any Arab territory by enemy forces aims to subject this land to what they falsely call Israeli sovereignty. This is evident in the cases of Palestine and the occupied Syrian Golan, where Israeli military presence has extended beyond mere military actions to include colonization efforts and, to a lesser extent, social and geographical changes in the occupied land. These actions are designed to subjugate the existing societies and benefit the enemy's economy. Therefore, any Zionist occupation of Arab territory, whether through military force or colonization, as seen in the West Bank, represents a new battle and consequently an additional challenge in our struggle to reclaim the land and restore our freedom. In addition to colonization, the adversary is actively working through its invasions to create a buffer zone that stretches from the administrative borders of the Syrian capital Damascus to the mountains along the Syrian-Lebanese border in the west and down to the Syrian-Jordanian borders in the south. Currently, there are efforts to expand this zone further eastward to reach the Syrian-Iraqi borders. This area will not only protect Israel from any resistance activities or the potential for future resistance between Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, but it will also reinforce the fragmentation of what remains of Syrian territorial unity, which is already divided among Turkish, American, and expanding Israeli occupations, both direct and indirect. Moreover, the Israeli occupation will strengthen its direct siege on resistance efforts in Lebanon, disrupting supply lines and posing a threat to the Lebanese resistance, particularly in the Baqa region in eastern and northeastern Lebanon. The presence of the occupying army on the highest peak of Mount Hermon puts the entire Baqa region within the sight and range of Israeli fire. As a result, the Israeli army no longer relies on the Air Force, as they are positioned at the top of the mountain with the Baqa Valley under their intelligence control. An Israeli soldier can survey the entire plain from south to north using binoculars and cameras. The significant loss of land in Syria is highlighted by the occupation of Mount Hermon, along with the desecration of its summit by Netanyahu and his soldiers. In addition to what's been mentioned about Mount Hermon, For those who may not know, this mountain not only overlooks Syria and the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, but also extends its view over Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. The summit of this mountain was taken by the occupying army in 1967 and was regarded as one of the challenging positions to reclaim due to its elevation. However, this hard-to-liberate land was regained by the heroes of the Syrian Arab army during the battle in October 1973. The battles of Mount Hermon, which lasted over 10 days, became historic scenes showcasing the heroism and bravery of the Arab soldier, particularly the Syrian Arab soldier who managed to achieve the impossible and return the summit of Mount Hermon to Syria. Since that moment, this peak has stood as an impregnable fortress against enemy plans, remaining secure until December 8, 2024, when a new Zionist invasion of Syria occurred. Mount Hermon symbolizes the additional challenges, not just geographical, that we as a people must overcome and confront. We will pay a steep price and make significant sacrifices to regain what we lost during the Zionist invasion of Syria and in our quest for the liberation of all Arab lands. This octopus-like expansion of the Israeli enemy will give it greater military superiority and an enhanced ability to shape the political landscape, as well as to promote partition plans and civil conflicts in three pivotal countries in the region: Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. At the end of the episode, we will explore a highly significant and risky political objective that the Israeli entity aims to achieve through its control over Syrian territory. The second type of loss following the Israeli invasion of Syria is the destruction of Syrian military capabilities. In fact, Israel's campaign against Syrian military strength did not begin on December 8, 2024. It actually dates back to the onset of the Syrian war in 2011. Since then, Israeli forces have targeted various Syrian military positions, particularly focusing on scientific research centers and air defense systems. During the same period, groups that would later be known as the Syrian Armed Opposition volunteered to dismantle Syrian air defense systems, despite having no role in the conflict other than confronting Israeli warplanes. It's also worth noting that just days before the fall of Damascus, the Syrian Arab Army was the only Arab military capable of challenging Israeli air power. Following significant losses to Syrian air defense systems, the Syrian army continued to resist, with air defense personnel becoming martyrs as they faced off against Israeli jets and missiles, despite the vast disparity in capabilities and the impact of the siege. It's worth noting that on February 10, 2018, the air defenses of the Syrian Arab Army successfully shot down an Israeli F-16 before it could enter Syrian airspace. However, the events that unfolded between December 8 and 12, 2024, were quite different. According to enemy reports and local assessments, over 90% of Syria's military capabilities were destroyed in just 4 days. This capability includes aircraft, remaining air defense systems, a vast array of missiles and tanks, as well as the complete destruction of the Syrian naval forces. More importantly, the vast majority, if not all, of the scientific research centers and numerous fortifications and strategic facilities that had been developed over decades were targeted and obliterated. The decline of Syrian military capacity is not a temporary setback. It represents a continuous loss. Why is this significant? Because the Syrian military capabilities supported all resistance efforts in the region, particularly those of the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance. When we look at the war media videos from the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, specifically Hezbollah, during the Al-Aqsa storm operation, we can see that the resistance fighters were using missile launch and control devices with instructions written in Arabic. Those with an interest in military affairs might find this scene quite unusual, as most weapons used in global conflicts, including those in our region, are typically imported from non-Arab sources. However, the weapons employed by the resistance to support Gaza and target enemy soldiers and tanks at the border were primarily, though not exclusively, of Syrian origin. Even the long-range missiles used by the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance to strike Haifa and Tel Aviv were mostly models developed in Syrian laboratories.
For this reason, the decline of Syria's military capabilities, especially among its scientists and research centers, poses a setback for the entire resistance project in the region. This setback must be acknowledged, not only to recognize the merit of each individual or to mourn the loss alone, but also to recognize that there is a great opportunity to integrate Arab minds into the resistance development project, and for the Syrian experience to continue to serve as a model for future endeavors. The third type of loss resulting from the Israeli invasion of Syria is the loss of consciousness, which could be the most devastating in the fight against the enemy. The ongoing invasion, with no announcement from the enemy regarding its end or any specific timelines or objectives, has been met with a concerning silence from the new leaders in Damascus. In media circles, elite groups, and even among some popular supporters of the new government, a wave of deeply troubling reactions has emerged, causing concern for every Arab who understands the implications of an Israeli invasion of Syria. Officially, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani's regime has remained completely silent regarding the Israeli aggression. The occupation of rural areas in Daraa has drawn condemnation from countries like Egypt and movements such as Hamas in Palestine. However, the new Syrian regime has not voiced any objection. Supporters defended this silence as a way to avoid provoking Israel, preventing it from declaring war on the new Syria and hindering the establishment of a state there. This reasoning is the same one we see whenever the new regime makes political and security concessions to countries like the United States, Germany, Saudi Arabia, and other nations involved in the genocide agenda, in exchange for allowing it to strengthen its power. In essence, the regime offers concessions to these countries, and in return, they permit it to solidify its authority. However, this justification sets a political precedent that has a profoundly negative effect on the consciousness of both the Syrian and Arab people. What the new leaders in Damascus reveal through their silence is that they are unconcerned about the lives and futures of the Syrian people in areas currently occupied or at risk of future occupation. In simple terms, when the Syrian regime addresses its citizens, it essentially states, if the Israelis decide that your village, city, or farm is part of their security obsession, may God help you endure the occupation because we cannot confront Israel. May God help you endure the occupation because we cannot confront Israel. This abdication of responsibility is evident not only in their silence regarding the occupation, but also in the complete lack of discussion about it, except on rare occasions. They neither take a stand, nor do they acknowledge the history of the occupation. In other words, the leaders in Damascus are conveying to the Syrian people that the occupation of Syrian territory and the enemy's expansion there is not a concern at all. It's not an issue that needs to be on the agenda, or even if we were to view it as a problem, it certainly isn't a priority. This brings us to an unprecedented situation in the Arab world, where we are witnessing the occupation of vast and strategically important areas of Arab land with remarkable calmness. It seems we have reached a point where it has become normal for Israel to occupy any land in the region and dictate the fate of its inhabitants. Why do we say this situation is without precedent? Because there are so many arguments and justifications for remaining silent in the face of this invasion that they seem capable of erasing the last remnants of human logic. The primary and most significant argument is that we should remain silent in the face of the invasion to strengthen the foundations of the new regime we just mentioned. Throughout many revolutions, coups, and regime changes, external threats have often provided a chance for emerging ruling powers to validate their plans, establish their legitimacy, and showcase their ability to govern. For example, the victory of the Cuban Revolution in 1959 was quickly followed by an attempted U.S. invasion using local tools in the battle that became known as the Bay of Pigs. In this struggle, the Cuban Revolutionary Forces, led by Fidel Castro, did not retreat or shy away from confronting the United States and its allies, despite the significant disparity in capabilities between the two sides. Instead, they stood their ground and validated the legitimacy of their government through their fight. In a different context, following the success of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the outbreak of the war between Iran and Iraq, the new Iranian government did not state that its main priority was to stabilize the internal situation, which would have meant surrendering to Saddam Hussein. Instead, the war and the massive mobilization that occurred during this time served as a means to stabilize the new regime and created a reservoir of popular legitimacy that continues to exist today. Instead, the war and the massive mobilization that occurred during this time served as a means to stabilize the new government and created a reservoir of people legitimacy and created a reservoir of popular legitimacy that continues to exist today. In summary, when a community affected by external aggression sees that the ruling power is ready to defend them and protect their territory, status, and interests, they no longer need to make an effort to show loyalty to the new regime. This straightforward observation makes it clear that the rationale for consolidating power, even from a practical standpoint, is weak and lacks coherence in everyday language. The second reason for remaining silent in the face of invasion, which is widely circulated among the grassroots supporters of the new government, is the priority of the weapon or which direction we should first aim our guns. During the Israeli invasion of Syrian territory, the armed forces of the new Damascus regime engaged in numerous battles, some of which were quite challenging. But the key question is, where did these battles take place? The fighting occurred along the Syrian-Lebanese border, in the coastal region of Syria, and against the Kurdish groups in the east. In the clashes with Lebanese tribes in the Arontes Basin, an area within Syrian territory that has been home to Lebanese families for over a century, Shaheen drones, projectiles, and large quantities of bullets and ammunition were utilized. In essence, the real issue isn't a lack of weapons or fighters, but rather the locations where these weapons are being used and the orientation of the combatants. The prevailing sentiment among the factions governing Damascus today is that the primary focus of their struggle should be against the forces of the resistance axis, particularly Hezbollah and Iran. This is not an accusation or slander, rather it reflects what Abu Muhammad al-Jolani has conveyed in various reassuring statements to the West, emphasizing that Syria would not serve as a launchpad for attacks against any parties, including Israel. Furthermore, al-Jolani has indicated that the real threats to Israel from Syria and Hezbollah, Iran, and Bashar al-Assad, whom he believes he has defeated, in the heart of Syria. In several interviews, al-Jolani discussed the Israeli invasion of Syrian territory, stating that there is no longer any justification for Israel's actions in Syria. He argued that Israel's main goal was to confront Hezbollah and Iran. However, after gaining power in Syria, al-Jolani shifted his perspective, claiming that Israel has no ambitions in Syria and did not pose a threat to the country. He suggested that there was no animosity between Syria and Israel, attributing the conflict instead to the rivalry between Hezbollah and Iran on one side and Israel on the other. This is the same Israel that occupies part of Syria, specifically the Golan Heights, which it considers its own territory and has received U.S. approval to annex, falsely referring to it as part of Israel. Al-Jolani's statement should not be viewed as insignificant. Rather, it represents a dangerous political stance that could influence the future of Syria and the entire region if not addressed appropriately. We return to what we mistakenly referred to as the margin of our earlier discussion. The notion of curbing hostility from supporters of the new Syrian regime towards Iran and Hezbollah. Previously, the rationale for this position was based on the claim that Hezbollah and Iran were meddling in Syria's internal affairs, regardless of the validity of that assertion. Now that Iran and Hezbollah have withdrawn from Syria, why does hostility towards them continue to be reprimanded? Why does hostility towards them continue to be a priority for some segments of the public and among Syrian officials? Additionally, why is this animosity not directed at Russia, despite accusations that its fighter jets have protected the regime and committed atrocities against Syrian civilians? This raises a clear rationale for the ongoing hostility that doesn't align with the previous claims. If those claims were accurate, there would be a direct declaration of enmity toward Russia. Instead, the Syrians are reaching agreements with the Russians and have allowed them to maintain their air base in the coastal region of Syria. This stance or behavior indicates a misalignment in the direction of the groups currently in power in Syria. It's important to note that these groups do not represent the majority of Syrians, even if they claim to speak on their behalf indefinitely. The confusion among these groups dates back to 2011 and stems from various factors. Most concerning is that it places Israel in a position of either an ally or an overlooked enemy. In both scenarios, the animosity towards Israel diminishes within the hearts of the people, which in turn weakens their understanding of the core of the Zionist project and the necessity for a proper response to confront the annihilation agenda. In return, hostility towards the countries and nations' constituents prevails at the expense of hostility toward Israel. As a result, the gun of the new rulers in Damascus echoes in all directions and aligns with the Merkava. The defeat of awareness may be one of the toughest aspects of the losses we are experiencing due to the Israeli invasion of Syria. Resisting this invasion requires several conditions, the foremost being the recognition that Israel is the primary and most significant enemy, and that standing up to Israel is the only path to achieving dignity, freedom, strength, and political legitimacy. The Syrian people, much like the Palestinian, Lebanese, and Egyptian communities, have a wealth of experience in resisting Israel. As we mentioned earlier, Syria, both as a nation and a people, serves as a cornerstone of the Arab and Islamic resistance movement. However, relying solely on history and past experiences, along with established beliefs about the Syrian people's hostility towards Israel, is not enough in today's context. Today, the responsibility lies with everyone. Even if one lacks the means to arm themselves and join the fight, there is nothing stopping them from voicing their opinions. The least that the new Syrian regime can do is to acknowledge its inability to engage in combat. At the very least, it could clearly reject the occupation and Israel's actions in Syria. We are free to express our views. The most important thing is to reignite the spirit of resistance in Syria, enhancing the awareness of the resistance and correcting the course that Syria helped to set, in which it played a vital role. We also need to connect with all those in the region and around the world who prioritize opposition to Israel, seeing it as a path to salvation and true freedom for Syria, and ultimately for all our nations.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, we have been talking about discontent and dissatisfaction in teens when it comes to appearance. So, Brother Liaqat, you told us in the previous episode some of the strategies how teens can be helping themselves. First of all, the problem lies in the social media world because they are so much comparing themselves and what social media has actually presented body image to them. They are they feel like this is something, this is perfection, and they need validation from every second person. So, like, how do we go ahead with these teens? You said some of the strategies, and I would want you to continue.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So I would start with a narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, where he says, "Al jamalu fil lisan wal kamalu fil aql." The Imam says, "Beauty is found in the language, while perfection resides in the intellect."
Right.
So according to Imam Ali alayhi salam, this is something beautiful. Like, beauty is in one's tongue, or is in one's
speech.
Language, is in one's speech.
Yeah.
You see, you know, even there are social influencers who have good speech.
Right.
Like, who kind of
speak good.
When they speak, they are speakers.
Motivators.
Who are really good motivators.
Right.
Yeah. Like, maybe they don't care too much about how they look.
Yeah.
Or what skin tone they have.
Right.
Or they're not gonna change their skin tone, or maybe like their eye color or whatever. Yeah. What they concentrate. And of course, it's amazing to listen to them. Yeah. Example, there are a few example scholars as well, who when they speak, it's like, oh wow, this is such a nice speech. Mashallah, such a nice insightful thing.
Right.
Example, if we see about Ayatollah Behjat itself, like, there are thousands and thousands and maybe like millions of people or hundreds of thousands of Shias inclined towards this noble personality. They are maraje, okay? They didn't go through any kind of appearance, surgeries and stuff. But we see Shias inclined towards them.
Yes.
Example, they are... and of course, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also places a lot of nur or light in them, like inside them.
Within them,
exactly. So, and of course, kamal or perfection is in the intellect, like how intellect a person is. So persons should definitely ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to grant him or her beauty in language. And of course, perfection in the intellect. And of course, I remember a story or an incident, I would say, of Hazrat Jaun alayhi salam on the day of Ashura. When he comes and seeks permission to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam,
to engage in the battle.
Yeah, exactly. And he, of course, at the end of the day, he was granted permission, and he goes and he gets martyred. And the Imam, this is one of those shuhada where the Imam comes and he keeps his face, his cheek on the cheek of the Shaheed.
And
Shaheed,
it's also important to note here, like, Imam gives him permission when he himself says, you are not giving me permission, maybe because of my appearance.
Yeah.
He says to Imam, because Imam says to him that, no, it's because like you have been serving.
Exactly, because he was slave of Hazrat Abu Zar Ghaffari. Yeah. And because he was a slave, so right. The Imam was a bit hesitant to give permission. But at the end of the day, after he's saying, is it because of my appearance? The Imam was like, no, not at all. And if you want to give, if you want to go to the battlefield, Bismillah, you can go. Like, he gives permission.
Yeah, and Imam actually mentions that you have been serving family for a very, very long time. Because from Abu Zar, he moves to Imam Ali. From Imam Ali to... like now Imam Hussain al-Islam, so he has been serving them for a very, very long time. Yes. So Imam Hussain al-Islam actually feels like he's already served a lot.
Yes.
He's already done a lot for us. And now it's like, now he wants to sacrifice his life as well. This is like too much.
Yeah.
But then John again, he says like, is it because of my appearance?
Indeed, it's so, so, so beautiful that like the Imam, regardless of what his color is, even like he keeps his... a cheek on the cheek of Hazrat John, alayhi
salam. Yeah. We'll discuss more about this brave personality after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadeer.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about one of the famous personalities of Ashura, that is Hazrat John. And he was dark in color. He was a slave, and he was actually from the African continent. And then he happens to be one of the martyrs in Karbala.
Yeah.
And Imam puts his cheek on his cheek, like he put his cheek on the cheek of Ali Akbar.
Yes, yes, exactly. So even when Imam Sajjad alayhislam comes to bury the bodies of the martyrs, he sees that there's a light which is shining bright from the body of Hazrat John alayhi salam
towards
and
the skies.
It's going towards the skies, and it is indeed like of course the du'as of Imam Hussein alayhi salam as well. And you know, if appearance is very important, then why would Imam keep his cheek on the cheek of John alayhi salam? So it's not appearance which is important. Just like he has kept his cheek on the cheek of his son Ali Akbar alayhi salam.
Yes.
So it's something else. It's not the surah, it's the seerah. It's not the appearance, it's the quality of the person,
right,
which brought the Imam like towards him, right, towards the person, and to such an extent like John was lying on the ground,
right,
and Imam went towards the ground in order to lay his cheek upon the cheek of Hazrat John, which is something. It is really something. So you know, even amongst the families of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, we see the wife of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam being a Nigerian.
Okay.
She, the mother of Imam Jawad alayhi salam, the mother of the ninth Imam, was from the African continent, yeah? And her skin tone was dark in color. So, which is the reason Imam Jawad alayhi salam was not white like his father.
Right.
Imam Rida alayhi salam was fair. He was proper Arab. And Imam Jawad alayhi salam had curly hair. Like, you know, like even the Africans, a few Africans have curly hair and stuff. And his color was not too white. He was not too dark. He was like the kind of moderate brownish, wheatish color kind of thing. So... and that is okay. That is not a problem. He's the Imam. He is of the
quality to be Imam, right?
And this lady, who is like, of course, the wife of Imam Rida alayhi salam, this noble lady got the opportunity to become the mother of an Imam.
Right.
So it's actually the quality which brought her to this stage, you see? So indeed, it's not the appearance. So I would say the teen shouldn't go after these kind of very hollow structured people.
Yes.
They should definitely choose those people as role models who have a lot of power in them,
right.
positive vibes in them,
right.
who have a lot of things to learn from them. In
right.
India.
Let's take a short break and continue the topic after a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here with us in the studio, and we're discussing about dissatisfaction and discontentment. So you said, number one, our teens have to distance themselves from the social media thing.
Yes.
They have to take a break. Number two, they have to actually surround themselves with the good people
mm-hmm.
who are satisfied with themselves. Actually, this was the third point, the number two point that you said.
Focus on self-acceptance.
Yes, accept who you are, what you are, how you are, acknowledge yourself. And number three was same, the support, surrounding yourself with the good people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said us about introducing some of the role models, which tell us the stories that to be focusing on Sirah, not the Surah.
Exactly.
To be focusing
and
on
also
the... Yeah, something beyond appearance.
Yes, exactly. Like self-worth beyond appearance
right.
is very important. Like my worth is not my appearance, right? That's what is very important. Like, for those teens, still there are a few people, there might be few people who still are behind appearance. You can get few teens, okay? Even after like minusing a lot of quantity amongst them, okay.
Still they have some.
There are people
obsessed
like
with self
who are yeah exactly who want to look really good. I would say them look for those who really want to look good, but they can't look good for any reason, like because they can't go through a lot of surgeries, because it's painful, because it's
heavily
budgeted, yeah, costly, and many other reasons, of course. Like maybe the parents are not going to support, whatever reason. I would say, look, the thing is, the appearance of the hereafter differs from the appearance of this world. So, if example, a person is looking not too fair, not too black, example, is medium skin tone, and the eye color is just like any other eye color, it's black in color, hair is black in color, example, okay? But imagine... if a person follows the steps of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, just like Joan, whose body was shining bright, okay? Because it was not his materialistic body. It's actually the heavenly body, which was having a lot of power, which was overpowering the materialistic body. You know, we have a riwayah, we have a narration where a person, a Shia, is going to see his hujjah of the time in his real appearance.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the time of Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, a person makes a wish or kind of last will to the Imam that when he is going to die, the Imam should come to meet him.
All right.
So when this person was on his deathbed, he sees the Prophet coming. So he says, "Assalamu alayka ya Rasulullah." He sees
right.
the first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the second,
so
the third, fourth, and you know, Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam was there, present, like in his bodily form,
right.
the hujjah, the proof of Allah on earth. And he says salam to Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, peace be upon you, O the son of the Prophet, O Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, as I see you in your original form, in your enlightened form.
All right.
So the Imam is in it. So other people are seeing the Imam in a bodily form.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, he's in a humanistic form. But he is like the Imam is shining bright.
Right.
You see? So if we kind of develop a quality in such a manner that our soul is enlightened, then we will see who we really are on
Allah
the day of judgment.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you
die.
Us the, which is called as Chashma Basirat.
Yeah.
Give us eyes of
Basirat. And the appearance is something
see
beautiful.
Things.
Yes.
Yeah, see things through.
Sure.
So Dear teens, be content with yourself. Do not compare yourself with these, I would say, artificial people. Be mature, act natural. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Brother Liaka. Thank you, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Dozens of Palestinians are killed in the latest Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip as the regime continues its aggression on the besieged territory. The Yemeni armed forces say they have shot down a U.S. MQ-9 drone over Hodeida and targeted U.S. warships in the Red Sea with drones and cruise missiles. And the EU chief says the bloc is ready to respond to the latest U.S. tariffs as Washington's trading partners slam Trump for imposing new levies. Thank you so much for joining us. More Palestinians are falling victim to Israel's incessant air and artillery strikes in Gaza, as the regime's genocidal war rages unabated across the besieged territory. Over 50 people were killed in the latest attacks across the Gaza Strip, including four people who lost their lives in an airstrike on tents housing displaced Palestinians in Khan Yunis. Also, Israeli fighter jets bombed a house in Gaza City, Sojaya neighborhood,